You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 7th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Nook, 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 nook.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, Evan.
How's everyone doing?
Hello, Jay.
Pretty good.
Very good.
Couldn't be better.
We have a full boat tonight, first time in a long time.
Full boat.
Yeah, welcome back, Bob.
Bob, welcome back.
Thank you. Five of a kind.
Bob, did you come down off your Halloween high yet?
Partly, but I spent all November working on the videos and the pictures, so I'm not fully down off of it until December.
Of course.
Guys, you want to hear something messed up?
Yes. Mm.
Always.
Bob, how many days until next Halloween?
Oh, well, taking into account leap year, it's about 359, I believe.
Okay.
Taking into account the leap year.
So have any of you seen the new show on NBC, Phenomenon?
Phenomenon. It's
I have
phenomenal.
Not watched it yet.
It's phenomenally lame, I hear.
Phenomenally lame is exactly what I meant. It's not as bad as everybody feared, though, because, you know, before it came out, all we knew was that Chris Angel was involved and Uri Geller was involved, and that spelled trouble. But I don't know. You guys have seen it, right?
Well, this is a reality show where Uri Geller and Chris Angel are testing magicians, mentalists, to like the American Idol of mentalism, basically.
Right. Yeah. They go on and they perform their tricks. The thing is, before it came out, nobody could really tell if they were going to try to find the next great psychic or the next great magician or what. They were really unclear in the commercials, but it turns out that they're really going for mentalists. So somebody who is a magician who doesn't claim to have any real paranormal powers.
Mm-hmm. So what's Geller doing on there?
Well, yeah, that's what was throwing everybody else off, because Geller is, you know, kooky and thinks he really can bend spoons with his mind.
No, he doesn't. He claims to think that he could bend spoons with his mind. We don't know what he really
thinks. I think he might be crazy enough to actually think that he can.
He's a second-rate mentalist who passes himself off as a real psychic.
Right.
Doesn't he say he gets his power from a spaceship, invisible spaceship that hovers above the Earth?
Whoa, I've never heard that.
Really?
Randy mentioned that in a lecture that he gave many years ago.
That's too funny. Well, there's one contestant on Phenomenon that claims to have real powers, although even that's kind of in question, because the guy went on and said that he could talk to the dead and all this stuff. And his website, on the one hand, he says that he can perform paranormal acts that can't be explained by science, but then in small print somewhere he's got he's just a magician.
Yeah.
So it's kind of up in the air exactly what he's pushing. But on the show, he's pretty much been 100% like, yes, I have real powers. So the funny thing that happened is last week, he was doing this awful, awful act where he was sitting on stage and he starts shaking and vibrating and he's holding a pen and he channels the spirit of a writer who is dead. And he shakily writes out what a Cosby kid has put in a box off on stage right.
The cartoon or the live action?
The live action.
Ah.
I think it was Rudy.
Rudy?
Yeah, or maybe that the one who was really cute, they brought on when Rudy started getting ugly, and so then they brought on the little girl who was ultra cute, and now she's chubby. I think it might have been her.
I see.
But anyway, before they started the show, she put something in a box. We don't get to actually see that happening. And so then the guy's on the stage, and he vibrates and froths at the mouth, and he ends up writing down something that says, like, rectangle, metal, four wheels. And it turns out to be a toy car. Oh, because, you know, that's how you would describe a toy car if you were dead and being channeled through some jerk on stage on a reality show. You would call it a metal rectangle with four wheels. And also you would spell wheels wrong without the H. Mm-hmm. So he's all excited. Audience applauds. The Cosby kid says, "Oh my God, that was great." And Uri Geller congratulates him on a job well done. And then Criss Angel whips out an envelope and says, "If you really have such great powers, why don't you tell me what's in this envelope?" Huh. And he offers the guy on stage and Uri Geller $1 million of his own money if they can tell him what's in the envelope. And of course they can't. There's much yelling that ensues.
Yeah.
Yelling? Bob, were you on there?
Yeah, I saw that. I saw the getting
It turned into Jerry Springer or something?
Yeah, but that was so staged. That had to be staged.
It looked a bit staged, just like Jerry Springer started to look staged in the later years, oddly enough. So it might have been staged, but yeah, the thing is, even if it's staged, it's still pretty cool that Criss Angel stepped up and got the skeptic voice out there.
One way or the other, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole mentalism gig is interesting now. I mean, it's always built on the persona, the magic persona, and making somebody think that you can do these amazing things. The whole profession's always sort of skated a little bit close to the line, and it was always benign and in fun and part of the act and part of the show. But the fact that there are people really claiming to be psychics or having magical powers and are using the mentalism tricks to con and defraud people, I think changes the nature of the game, changes the ethics of the profession of mentalism. And as a profession, they do, I think, just have to be absolutely clear. This is not magic. This is not psychic power. This is illusion. This is a trick.
Yeah. You look at how Banachek, for instance, does it. He was one of the kids in the Alpha Project that Randy put on years ago, where Randy had two kids infiltrate this study of psychics, and he had them pretend to be psychics, only they were doing magic tricks the entire time for months at a time. And they ended up fooling all of these quote-unquote scientists into believing that they had psychic powers. Well, one of the kids was Banachek, who is now an incredibly successful, incredibly talented mentalist. And Banachek does not claim to have any psychic powers. He does his show, he does it brilliantly, but without ever claiming to be psychic.
Yeah. And I think the best ones are confident enough in their performance that they don't have to do that. And now it's almost like the ones that are not as good are using it as a cheap and easy way to enhance their performance, you know?
Right. And I just want to add that one of the reasons why I wasn't too worried about the show phenomenon being overly credulous is because Banachek has been involved in it from the beginning.
Yeah, that's excellent. So, Bob, you've been gone for a while.
Yes.
So we want to do some techie, enthusiastic, cool news story this week for you. And you sent me this one on the DARPA challenge and the robotically driven cars. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this article really piqued my interest. It was something that reminded me, this challenge, this autonomous vehicle challenge that DARPA's been running, this latest iteration of that kind of reminded me of an article I read over 20 years ago, and I wish I kept it. It said something like this: there's something new coming to the internet. It's called the World Wide Web. The very first hint of the World Wide Web that I ever came across, and little did I know that the internet is synonymous with the World Wide Web. I mean, what else is there really to the internet? And this seems like that to me. DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency of Pentagon, has been sponsoring for years now this autonomous vehicle challenge. This one was called the Urban Challenge. The first 2 years, they had it in the desert. I remember they were just off-roading vehicles. The first year, all the vehicles broke down.
Yeah, they did terribly.
So, it was pathetic. I remember being so disappointed. Like, my God, none of them could finish this course. And then the second year, many of them passed. Many of them finished, and they did well. And this year, they really stepped it up. They created this urban challenge. It's an urban-style obstacle course at a former Air Force base. And for 6 hours, I think it's like a 55-mile course that they had to run, encountering real-world things like stop signs and streetlights and other vehicles, some autonomous, some cars driven by stunt drivers. They had to drive in circles. They had to park. They had to do all this stuff. So it seemed a real leap in terms of complexity than just like driving around in the desert. And Carnegie Mellon university's car called Boss. It was a Chevrolet Tahoe. They nicknamed it Boss. They actually didn't finish first, but they performed best, and they won $2 million.
Nice.
So I love these kinds of contests because it really spurs development. I think it really accelerates.
Yeah, in just a few years, the technology has taken off. It's really a steep incline.
Right, and it's at such a level now that even the DARPA director, Tony Tether, said that the technology for robotic vehicles is now just about ready for other companies and organizations to pick up the work in honing it further. He actually had another quote that was interesting. Kind of expanding on this, he said that DARPA is an interesting organization. We really never finish anything. All we really do is show that it can be done. We take the they take the technical excuse off the table. They just let people know that, well, look, we can do this. Now run with it, and people will run with it. And they have plans. They have plans to outfit a significant percentage of their military vehicles by 2015 with this technology, and the benefits are obvious. You've heard of all the what are they called? The improvised explosive device?
Explosive device, IEDs.
Yeah, can you imagine a fleet of these trucks? You know, a truck gets blown up. Oh, well, you know, there's a lot of money, but nobody died. And then, of course, eventually, I'm not sure how long this will take, but I envision a day when many, many cars that anybody could buy will at least part of the time be controlled by computers.
Yeah. That's the question. How long until it's like the movie Total Recall where you get into a car and say, take me here.
Right.
And the car just drives you wherever you want to go.
Jay, maybe you remember this. I've been talking for 20 years. I've been saying we got to get to the point where we can do this. When I realized how many people died on the roads every year, 50,000 people about, like,
in the U.S.
In the United States, Vietnam, that's how many people died, that's how many Americans died in Vietnam every year.
And
to me, it's just incredible. And can you imagine at some point the number of deaths will be in, you know, in the low thousands or hundreds? It'll be almost unheard of to have a car accident.
Well, that will probably be the interim technology too, before robots completely take driving out of our hands, where there is still a human driver, but the
right.
car can take over if an accident's about to happen.
Yeah, it's computer assist.
Your attention wavers from the road.
You know, they shouldn't really call it robot. Like, the robots are not driving these vehicles. It's software.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's not like there's a humanoid robot sitting behind the wheel, which would actually be a lot cooler, in my opinion.
Johnny Cab. Hello, I'm Johnny Cab.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
There's another aspect to this why I find this interesting. To me, I mean, I enjoy driving, but to me, it's a colossal waste of time. So much time is spent behind the wheel. I had an hour commute each way to work for 7 or 8 years, and that's how I got into books on tape. I've got like 200 books on tape that I listen to over and over and over because I figured, wow, as long as I'm in the car, I might as well make it as productive as possible. And then and that's how it's going to be when these cars become fully autonomous for the average American. You know, you'll be able to take a nap, you know, read the newspaper, you know, do all these other things instead of driving, you know, these cars.
Will driving become a lost skill, an obsolete lost skill?
I don't think so. You could pick up driving relatively quickly. It's not like you need to drive for 20 years to become proficient at it.
I don't know. You have to drive for, you know, a while, though, before you become, you know, reasonably good at it.
I never got reasonably good at it.
I don't think that art will ever be lost. I'm sure when it becomes totally within the society and it's really widespread, I can imagine, you know, these certain roads or certain areas where people want to just drive just for the fun of it, that you'll be able to do it. But the vast majority of people, they really won't have a need to drive at some point.
Yeah. It'll be like horseback riding.
Right.
I would imagine the first cars are going to be able to, you know, you could tell the car to take you to a location, but there'd still be a driver interface. And then later on, there'll be cars where it's just one big interior with no wheel or anything. It's all going to be done by computer.
That's good for the elderly and folks like that who have challenges driving.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, a lot of accidents are caused by simple inattention. That is just a weakness in our perception and ability to attend to details constantly. Our attention can be drawn away, and we literally might not see something like an obstacle in the road. In fact, have you guys seen the basketball video? That I linked to from my blog a few weeks ago.
No.
Okay, I don't want to tell you what the upshot is. I'll link to it again
from the
notes page.
I know it.
Yeah. Don't say what the answer is, but it's a good example of strengths and weaknesses of being able to pay attention. Once you do that demonstration, it's really easy to believe why somebody can driving just absolutely not see something on the road. It's also probably why cell phones increase the risk of driving so much. Your attention is being drawn away and you're not processing the information that's the visual information on the road.
Yeah, even if it's hands-free.
Yeah. So robots are perfect for that because they don't lose their attention, right? Assuming that they're functioning, the software and the sensing and et cetera. So it could just, I think for a while, even while there's still a human driver, it will add another layer of safety, you know, for the driver by being attentive and not missing anything.
I could think of several circumstances where a computer-driven car would be great, you know. That would get rid of drunk driving. That would get rid of falling asleep behind the wheel. You know, I found over the past couple of years, there's a lot of times when I really don't think I should be driving because I'm too tired.
But you do anyway.
And what do you do? Yeah, like, what do you do in that circumstance? You
pull over, fall asleep.
Who does that?
Jay, it's hard.
A lot of people do it.
But you would be surprised how impaired you are, even if you're just a little bit drowsy. It's like being completely smashed. I mean, you wouldn't think of driving after drinking five or six beers, but that's pretty much what it's equivalent to if you're really drowsy. And I've had those situations where, you know, you're actually the split second before you open your eyes, you're like, "Holy crap! I just closed my eyes and I'm driving." And for that split nanosecond, you're like, "What am I going to see when I open my eyes?"
Yeah.
Well, it would be nice to, at that point, just to put it on autopilot and say, take me home.
Well, you ever drive and you're thinking deeply about something or something and you realize you're at your destination and you didn't, you know, really pay attention to every little thing on the way there, right?
Yeah,
I think part of your brain kind of takes over.
Yeah, that's a very normal experience to have.
That happens to me while I'm having sex. I just kind of tune it out, you know.
Yeah, so does she.
Yeah, you walked into that one, Jay.
I gave it to her.
Oh, yeah, it's true. That was low.
Set him up and knock him
low hanging fruit, no pun intended. All right.
I wasn't even paying attention to the conversation. I just popped that in there, sounded
that's good,
good timing.
Yeah, it's like we could actually liken that to how Rebecca does these podcasts. Just totally on autopilot.
Ooh, wow.
Hey, now.
Okay.
Rebecca has an egg timer over there, and whenever it goes off, she's like, "Oh, I'm here. Hi." Oh,
yeah. I was replaced with a robot 3 weeks ago, actually.
That's true. We're having some technical difficulties with it, but it'll get better.
What are you talking about? We've been getting a lot of fan mail.
Rebecca Bot.
Rebecca Bot 2007.
Cool.
Is it wrong that I find that a little sexy?
I knew you were going to say it.
Please.
In our ongoing public service announcements on how pseudoscience kills, we have a new story this week. This one involves the death of a Jehovah's Witness. This is not a new type of story, but this one has been making the rounds. A lot of people emailed this to us. Evan, you read up on this.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, it's horribly sad. These are always, that's the first thing I feel about these stories. It's just, you know, it kind of hits me. And to think about the people, you know, not only just the people who have died, but also the family members kind of left behind to do the grieving. It really hits hard. But in any case, the woman's name was Emma Goh, and she was 22 years old, and she had just given birth to a set of twins. She was also just recently married to her husband, Anthony. And there were complications. The article doesn't explain exactly what the complications were. As she was there experiencing this blood loss and slipping away, the hospital staff asked the husband they begged him to allow a blood transfusion to occur to save her life. And the husband, Anthony, said no and refused it because it was against the religious tenets of the Jehovah's Witness for blood transfers of any kind. And she wound up dying as a direct result of this.
Right. Yeah, that's one of those situations that we as physicians really hate. You know, it's obvious what the right thing to do is, but the beliefs of the patient or the family don't allow it. It could be very, very frustrating. And of course, you know, she was an adult. She has the right to make that decision for herself. You know, obviously we don't think it was a very rational decision, but there's nothing you could do about it.
Right.
It reminded me, you know, recently or last month I wrote about that cardiovascular physician, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is, you know, one of the few physicians who are really pushing, you know, spiritual and alternative medicine. And he used a when he was interviewed for a recent podcast that was very that was promoting this kind of thing, he gave the example of a patient he had who was a Jehovah's Witness who refused the blood transfusion. He was certain that she would die without it, and she miraculously pulled through, and everybody was happy. It's like, and at the time, and I wrote about this.
So
what a misleading example to give. I mean, this story is much more typical. You know, the person who refuses a blood transfusion when everyone's sure they're going to die, and guess what? They die. That's what happens most of the time. But he was using this, you know, ridiculously unrepresentative example to try to make it sound like it's this is all good. It's all good to, you know, to practice spiritual medicine. I thought it was just really rubbed me the wrong way.
Have you ever read the Bible passage that one of the Bible passages that this belief is derived from?
Hit it.
Leviticus 17:10, and any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. Eats my blood. Well, first, they took that and twisted it for a blood transfusion as well.
Well, what I discovered about this is that this particular piece of doctrine that the Jehovah's Witnesses teach, they decided to enact on it or make it part of the doctrine in 1945. Mm-hmm. They decided at some point, just the folks that were running the establishment at that time came to the conclusion and all of a sudden said, yeah, well, this is the way it's supposed to be. Now, the Jehovah's Witness has been around since the 1870s, and it was not part of their original indoctrination.
Yeah, but how do they get transfused from eating? It's like, okay, don't eat blood. You know, that probably had something to do
problem.
With being pure or clean and, you know, not tainted. But how do you go from that to transfusion?
There's a second part to this specific story, and it was just an update that came out today. And the original story was put out a few days ago, and now the follow-up is that the husband, Anthony, is claiming that the medical staff was negligent over his wife's death. And that he insists that the wife would have submitted to a transfusion if it had used her own recycled blood. And he is claiming that at some point that was discussed and the staff did not know how to correctly use the blood cell salvage machine, is what they're calling it.
Mm-hmm.
He feels that is why she died.
Yeah, that's cognitive dissonance at work. I mean, he's just trying to, you know, point to something other than the decisions that he made.
Right.
You know,
but, I mean,
I have no firsthand knowledge of the details of that case. Maybe, you know, they didn't do everything perfect. Who knows? But, I mean, it's very common in situations like that for people to seek out some way to characterize what happened that reduces or softens the blame on themselves.
But then I found, Steve, that amongst the medical procedures that are prohibited by Jehovah's Witness doctrine is, in fact, transfusions of preoperative donated autologous blood.
Mm-hmm.
So that directly kind of defies what the husband here is saying. And it seems to, you know, there seems to be a wide spectrum of people in the Jehovah's Witness faith that take this very seriously, don't take it seriously at all, or fall somewhere, you know, on that spectrum. And there's actually a group, an organization of Jehovah's Witnesses called the Associated Jehovah's Witnesses for Reform on Blood, the AJWRB. And according to their website, they're a group of witnesses from many countries who they volunteer their time to teach people, and especially other witnesses, in an effort to bring about the end to the what they call the misguided policy that has claimed thousands of lives, many of them children.
Yeah, I mean, good for them that they're trying to change that. Historically, what typically happens is that they just form a splinter group, and then you get two reformed Jehovah's Witnesses and the classic Jehovah's Witnesses. Religions tend to splinter over time over these kinds of issues. The next news item is a new study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, where researchers looked at the death rates of people of various weights. And what this study showed is that the if you break up people into underweight, normal weight, overweight, and obese, that the category that had the lowest death rate was actually the overweight category. So being overweight, which has a specific definition according to body mass index, was associated with actually the lowest mortality rate, better than people who were within the normal weight range as currently defined. A very interesting study. It's also not the first study to show this, but what they did do is they looked at specific reasons why the different groups were dying. So they broke it down by causes of death, not just overall mortality. Some of the findings were not surprising. People who were obese did have a higher rate of dying from heart disease. Not a big surprise. The overall death rate in the obese population was not greater due to cancer. The death from cancer was not greater overall in the obese category. That was a bit of a surprise to some, and contradicts some earlier studies which show that obesity does increase the risk of certain cancers. Although the reason for that is that some cancers that are known to be to occur at a higher rate within obesity were higher in this study, but it was balanced by other cancers for which there was a lower rate than for the population who was of a normal weight. So, and the net effect was, you know, washed out. So it was not surprising that people who are underweight also had a higher mortality rate. They died more from everything except for heart disease and cancer. This is obviously has a lot of significance for, you know, public health initiatives. There's been a lot of effort recently to try to reverse the trends of increasing weight in this country, and probably we still need to do that. That being obese and the number of people in the United States that is obese and in Western industrialized countries in general has been increasing over the last few decades, and that has been correlating with higher rates of diabetes and heart disease in the obese population. So I think the evidence still supports efforts to try to combat obesity, but perhaps the healthy ideal should not be the athletic sort of physique with the very, very low body fat, you know, the six-pack abs. It may not necessarily be the healthiest. This data supports previous data that suggests that, you know, having 10 or 20 pounds on you may actually be the optimal for health.
That's bullshit.
you don't accept that, Bobby? If that causes some cognitive dissonance for you?
I accept it. I just don't like it.
Yeah, it is interesting that, you know, the relationship between the cultural ideal for aesthetics and our perceptions of what is healthy. And historically, those things have tended to go hand in hand. So at times and places where it was believed that being overweight was healthy, that also then became the aesthetic ideal. And certainly in our modern culture, there is the belief that being extremely, not extremely thin, but being thin, having a low body fat is healthy. And that is the aesthetic ideal. But I wonder how much of it, you know, what's causing what? You know, how much of the cultural belief that thin is beautiful, it derives from the sense that it's healthy, or vice versa, how people believe that it's healthy because it's the aesthetic ideal.
Yeah.
And I wonder if this information is enough to actually change the cultural ideal.
No way.
Well, 10 to 20 pounds, Steve, that also depends on the person's, you know, build and height and everything as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, but that's a, you know, that's a rough, you know, estimate. You could be most people, you know, average build, average height. You know, if you're, you know, 10 to 20 pounds over what is considered by the current standards to be optimal, that's in the overweight category. Those are the people who live the longest. You get beyond that, then other things start to kick in. And, you know, actually, it makes sense to me. It makes sense that why would there be a significant detriment to carrying an extra 10 or 20 pounds? I mean, I don't know why physiologically that would be such a strain on our body that it would increase the risk of anything. Well, being obese, it's obvious. You know, that the more weight, the more obese somebody is, there's lots of stressors that puts physiologically, you know, on the body. So it makes sense. It also makes sense that people who are underweight would have a higher mortality rate. It's because, you know, the body's not getting the nutrition that it needs. But I don't know, it's not intuitive to me why the so-called normal weight category had a higher death rate than the overweight category. That's the part that I don't know that we have a good explanation for. Unless it's just, you know, optimal for us to have somewhat of a layer of fat, and that just the image that we have of somebody who's optimally healthy and thin is just not what's optimal for us, you know, physiologically.
Steve, I wonder how that works with the idea of the whole of restricting your caloric intake, and how it's been shown that doing that, restricting caloric intake for animals like mice and things, greatly extends their lifespan.
Yeah, I thought about that too. That occurred to me is that, you know, what about the calorie restriction causing life extension literature? You know, how does this mesh with that? And yeah, you brought up some of the points. Either what happens to mice when you calorie restrict them does not really translate into humans, and wouldn't be the first time that mouse data didn't translate into human clinical effect. Or voluntary calorie restriction over a period of time triggers something else, you know, biochemically that may produce longevity, but that effect wasn't producing a measurable signal in this data just because not enough people are doing it. And people who are the other thing is to keep in mind with the underweight population is that they could be underweight because they're sick. You know what I mean?
Right.
So saying, yeah, sure, of course they have a higher mortality rate. They're underweight because they're sick to begin with. So, and this is certainly also not the end of the story, right? This is just, it was a very large, very interesting study. Definitely have to take this seriously. There is something going on here. That this data is telling us something. But, you know, this kind of data needs to be looked at frontwards and backwards and sideways, and every possible angle needs to be examined before we really know how to interpret it. Next news item, this is just a quick announcement almost. Next week on Nova, airing at November 13th at 8 p.m., is a show called Judgment Day, Intelligent Design on Trial. And it is going to go over the Dover intelligent design trial from a couple of years ago. Should be a very, very interesting show. So that's going to be on the 13th. I just wanted to give our listeners a heads up. They might want to take a look at that. The intelligent design guys are already griping about it.
Oh, boy.
They're already grousing about it over at the Discovery Institute. You know,
deal with it.
Of course they are.
Gee, I wonder why.
What were they complaining about, Steve? Any details?
Yeah, they're just, you know, they're complaining that this is just pushing the Darwinist agenda, you know. It's just a big conspiracy to push Darwin onto the culture. Well, a quick follow-up on the Bigfoot picture we had from last week, which turned out to be a mangy black bear. I mentioned, we were talking about whether or not malnutrition causes mange or the other way around, and I thought that mange was a symptom of being underweight or starved or ill. It turns out that that mange specifically refers to a condition that is caused by a parasite, the mange parasite, which causes the loss of hair and also the malnutrition and being ill. So you guys were actually correct. The mange does cause, you know, being thin and being sick because it's caused by a parasite.
Let that be a lesson to you. We're always right.
Yeah. Yep, that's called the hasty generalization. Thanks, Rebecca.
No problem.
The mange hypothesis is just the most overwhelmingly likely explanation. It's not like they found it and determined.
Yeah, they didn't capture this animal, but there was more data than what was available to us last week. And apparently, in this part of the country, this is at this time of year and in that place, they're having lots of bears, and they're having lots of mangy bears. This is, you know, like a very common occurrence. The rangers and the people who are the naturalists out there know exactly what this is. This is not mysterious at all.
Yeah. Hey, boo-boo, what's wrong with your skin?
Hey, boo-boo.
Gee, Yogi.
So just that minor correction on the whole mange thing. Well, let's go on to your questions and emails. This first one comes from Kenzie Douglas from Harrisonburg, Virginia, and she writes, "My name is Kenzie, and I have been a big fan of yours for over 6 months. I mention that because my boyfriend is a huge, huge fan of yours, and he got me hooked as well. I am emailing you because my boyfriend's birthday is November 10th, and I thought it would be wonderful if you could email him to wish him a happy birthday. I already bought him one of your t-shirts, and if you could do this for me, I will get major brownie points in the girlfriend department. I know you must get tons of requests like this, but he would seriously flip out if you were to do this. Please, 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 please help a fellow skeptic out. Thank you, Kenzie." And she says,
flipping.
P.S., his name is John Marrier, and he is turning 20 years old. So we decided to do you one better, Kenzie, and actually wish John a happy birthday on the podcast.
Happy birthday, John.
Happy birthday, John.
Happy birthday, John.
Well done.
Actually, Kenzie, well, for two reasons. One, because it happens to be the day that we're going to be uploading the podcast, so the timing works out. But also, this is actually the first birthday request we've had from a listener.
It is.
So
it is.
Not the last.
But it will be the last one we ever do on the show.
Yeah, obviously we're not going to be able to wish every listener a happy birthday on our show, because fortunately we have far too many listeners for that. But since you were the first, then we decided to do it. You get the prize for being the first one to ask us.
What I suggest to our listeners is that if it is their birthday, assume that we are wishing them privately a happy birthday.
Yes, we will be psychically sending you happy birthday wishes.
Now, listeners are going to try to figure out what they can be the first to ask us to do so that we'll have to do it. This isn't a good precedent to set.
No, do it. Do it.
John, you treat your girl good.
Because we could always just not do it if we don't want to. But hey, take a chance. And I do recommend that you do buy t-shirts for all of your friends and family who are having birthdays.
All of them.
Absolutely.
Even if they've never heard of us before. They'll love it.
Right.
Where can they get that t-shirt?
Why, I'm glad you asked.
Thanks, Bob. I'm sure there's a button somewhere on our homepage that says Buy SGU Stuff. Just follow that link.
There was once a time when everybody believed in at least some form of God, and religion ruled the world. It was called the Dark Ages. Look, they act like I set out to be famous, talking out the anus. Then go on and describe my lyrics as heinous. It's funny how threatening music is, ain't it? To the typical, modern, theistically hypocritical ignoramus. I gives a damn what your name is. For all intent and purposes, you can remain nameless, or have the same name as Jesus, Buddha, Zeus, or Muhammad. Worshipping every star in the sky, plus Ailey's Comet. Why don't you believe in God? Why don't you believe in Ra? Huh? Why don't you turn to the East daily and pray to Allah? I don't know. I'm just a guy speaking the facts. If you don't like it, you can leave through the back. Creationism is a joke, and I'll leave it at that. Look at these so-called damn brothers. Look, hell, I might as well be looking at their grandmothers. Uh-huh. That's where they get it from. Anyway.
Joining us now is Graydon Square. Graydon, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
How's it going?
Now, Graydon, you are a hip-hop rap artist who sings and raps about skeptical and non-believer topics, which is certainly unusual. I don't think it's unique. I think there are some other rationalist rappers out there, but certainly aren't many of you. What got you? What made you decide that this was going to be your career? That you're going to be a rationalist rapper?
Actually, I didn't decide that. I became an atheist far after, you know, I started rapping. I started rapping at, like, you know, 17. In fact, on my 18th birthday, I think I wrote my very first song. So my leaving religion had something to do mostly with my ex-girlfriend, and she had said something universally stupid, and basically I took that and wrote a song about it, and it went over well in an Atheist Nation video that I did on YouTube. And so people were like, are you going to continue to do more atheist stuff? You know, we need a voice. You know, we need an actual voice out there. And I'm like, okay, that'll work. So I started doing it.
What was the stupid thing she said?
She said, and it's funny because it's like me and her are kind of cool now, or, you know, as far as we talk occasionally, and she doesn't like me telling anybody, but, you know, I just use it to kind of, you know, whatever. She said that the reason that people in Africa are so rife with poverty and disease is because they haven't accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and personal Savior.
Hmm. Wow.
That's pretty serious.
That's bad enough to inspire me to rap.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's like, you say something like that, and I'm just like, you know, dude, that's all kind of screwed up.
Now, were you in school at the time? Did you start? I read on your website that you're a physics major.
I was in school, yeah. I've been in school now. It seems like forever. Of course, I started in sound engineering school. I, you know, of course, been involved in music for a while. I was going to sound engineering school. That's actually how me and the ex-girlfriend met. And then basically I chose my career path right around the time I became an atheist. One had nothing to do with the other. It's just I've always liked, you know, science fiction, and most science fiction, you know, was based on, you know, the violation of most laws of physics that we know of. So I was like, hey, that sounds like something that'd be clue going to, so I just kind of took it and ran with it.
Do you know, where do you want to go with it?
Well, I know I'm going to go and get my doctorate. Eventually, I'll be doctor grade and swear. But, you know, right now, I mean, I'd like to work, you know, in research. I don't think I'd ever want to teach just because I don't have the patience for it. But I'd like to go into research. You know, I'd like to work for Lockheed Martin or, you know, NASA or something like that, JPL.
Mm-hmm. So when you get your physics degree, are you going to start rapping about quarks and bosons?
I've actually started writing songs about physics. Nobody has ever heard them before.
Uh-huh.
Simply because right now I don't think it's a good time for me to kind of release that stuff. I do have a song on my new album coming out called Quantum Vacuum, and it talks about, you know, basically just stuff, you know, involving very, very far-reaching and theoretical and, you know, string theory and you know, quantum mechanics and stuff like that. Just, you know, stuff that you could read in a Michio Kaku book or, you know, somewhere.
Right. I got to hear this stuff.
I'm a total dork geek, and I got to tell you, I stumbled on your YouTube video, I think 6 months or so ago, and I watched a few, and I wanted to hear more of your music. And I got so excited to hear about your lyrics because, you know, they intellectually engage me. You know, they're not insulting to me. You know, it's not like it's just mindless. Like, I have to pay attention to what you're saying. I loved it. I just was really into it. It's actually it's totally different than all other rap music to me because it's engaging a part of my brain that is never engaged when I listen to music. And I think it's cool.
I almost kind of look at it, you know, in hip-hop. I mean, I'll be the first one to say it. I mean, I know a lot of my friends who are involved in music as well, they don't like me saying this because they feel like, you know, it's not that what I'm about to say is true. It's just that most people who are exposed to what I'm about to say is not exposed to the right what I'm about to say. So that being said, hip-hop sucks right now. You know, that's just the sheer reality of it. When people say rap music sucks, they're right. Nobody in the industry, you know, with the exception of maybe Nas, and I think if you catch, you know, M on a good day, you know, and of course Cannabis, are people who are actually talking about things. I mean, and I'm talking commercially now. Who are actually talking about things that are relevant in today's society. When you go into the underground, of course, you get people who are Talib Kweli, Common, Mos Def. You know, I mean, you get people like that. But for the most part, hip-hop sucks, period. You know, and the fact of the matter is the people who are conscious rappers, who you know, will spit knowledge and put knowledge out there, don't make these other guys accountable for the songs that they do. You know, we as, I think, and I hate to say it like this because it sounds as arrogant as hell, but we as intellectual superiors don't try to bring other people up to that. And if we do, I don't think we try hard enough, and myself included. I don't try to do it. I'm like, well, if they're dumb, let them be dumb. You know, some people choose it. But no, I think hip-hop sucks right now, and that's just the sheer reality of it.
Do you think it's just become diluted over the years?
I think that the fact of the matter is that the older generation did not hold the newer generation. And when I say older generation, I mean the Ice Cubes and the Tupacs and the Jay-Z's and the Nas's didn't hold the Master P's and the Cash Money's and, you know, the T.I.'s responsible for the things that they would say and the things that they would, you know, do. And so those rappers, the second generation, didn't hold the next generation accountable, the Soulja Boys, the people like that. They don't hold those people responsible because they don't know what it's like to be held responsible for the things that they say. People last so short in this industry. They don't, you know, you get rappers who come out and they're literally 1 month rappers. You hear about them for 1 month, and then the next month there's somebody coming in right in to take their place.
Just like any other style of music, it got absorbed into the machine, and I'm not surprised to hear you say that at all.
Do you think the problem is more an artistic problem with the genre, or do you think that it's the culture of hip-hop and the content of the music that they're putting out now?
Well, the culture of hip-hop has this misunderstanding. People think that, you know, I think the hip-hop heads, the true hip-hop heads, think that hip-hop is a culture based on, you know, the old b-boy days. And I think, you know, the outsiders looking in, people who aren't familiar with the hip-hop culture, think that hip-hop culture is about the subjugation and the object, you know, the objectification of women. They think it's about, you know, violence and drugs and money and sexploitation. And, you know, it's none of that. The fact of the matter is hip-hop culture is urban culture. I think it's, we put a friendly spin on it and say, oh, it's hip-hop culture. That's just another way of saying it's the black guys. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I know people are all racially sensitive now about, there are people out there. I mean, just in all honesty, there are people out there who are so sensitive about these things. Yeah. You know, it just doesn't make too much of a difference anymore.
It was really cool listening to your songs because, you know, I'm not used to hearing a rap song or a hip-hop song that contains the words punctuated equilibrium and Pascal's wager.
Yeah.
You know,
no, isn't that a trip?
In fact, it was like, yeah, it's a trip. It's like listening almost to conversations we have, and you're saying a lot of the same things that skeptics would say, but you're doing it with all of the emotion and attitude, you know, that hip-hop is really good at, you know, and it really adds... My experience was it's just it really added a very in your face emotional layer to the kind of stuff that we say and talk about anyway.
Right. I don't know. When I used to write songs back in the day, I'm actually considering on the day that the CPT theorem comes out, June 5th, 2008, I'm actually thinking about releasing my very first album, the one that was before the Compton Effect, at the same time on the same day.
What was the name of that album?
Absolute. That album was called Absolute. I recorded that album when I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And completely different. I mean, just me. I wrote those songs based probably 159% on emotion.
Mm-hmm.
It's just straight raw emotion. Now I'm writing songs like, you know, 80% on intellect and 20% on emotions. It takes me a lot to write a song emotionally now because it takes a lot to get to my emotions. Using, you know, logic. I mean, most of the time I can use logic to diffuse most situations, you know, rationality and critical thinking to diffuse most situations. So emotion is not really involved. Believe it or not, whether they admit it or not, most people want to be stimulated intellectually. But nobody wants to feel dumb when they're being stimulated. You ever talk to that really, really smart guy who knows he's really, really smart and he talks to you like he's really, really smart?
Yeah.
Nobody wants that. Everybody wants somebody, I think, who is intelligent but can explain it to them in everyday, you know, everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Things that they can relate to every day.
Let me ask you a question because I have this problem. I've said it on the show before. I've had Evan, Steve, and Bob have actually kind of walked me off the edge a few times. I get very angry as a skeptic. There's a lot of anger involved in it with me because I get so frustrated and I feel like I can't do anything about it. And does that ever come into play with you? Because when I've listened to your music, I can hear you driven, but I don't hear like any real anger in there.
There was anger in the song "Say." There was anger in the Compton Effect. There was anger if you listen to "Dream," actually. Am I upset at the current situation? Of course I am. You know, does it get me to the point where I would consider myself pissed off? Yeah, but at the same time, I know that being pissed off and from what I do is not going to change anything. What I need to do is get other people pissed off.
Yeah.
So that other people can feel what I feel and then turn around and use it.
And Graydon, what's been the response, especially among the black community? It really interests me to see. Do you feel like you're really reaching out to people who had never thought this way before? Do you feel like you're converting people, so to speak, to skepticism?
Most of the time, I try to tell most people that I don't seek to convert anybody to anything. Most people will either go further to the left or further to the right. You know, it's not like they will go from left to right or right to left. I don't think anybody has ever, you know, sent me a letter or sent me, you know, any type of mail saying, you know what, I was a Christian and now I'm an atheist after listening to your music. Most of the time, it's like, you black son of a bitch, I'm going to kill you and your kids when you decide to have them.
Oh, you know, God,
it's like, okay, but that's great and all, but what'd you think about the CD? And they're like, oh, the CD is fine. Yeah.
So long as they bought it, right?
Yeah, it doesn't happen that often. I mean, out of all the emails we get, you know, we've had a handful of emails where we've had people admit to a full, you know, 180-degree turn on their beliefs by our input, which we've said before is amazing, but it doesn't happen as often as we'd like.
Well, I get more hate email, you know, in response to the question. I get more emails from the black community that are hateful than I get from any other type of community. Simply because, of course, black people tend to be more religious or more fundamentalist in nature. I recently got an email on my YouTube account when a guy told me, and I want to read it to you guys. It's pretty interesting. He says, and this is from, well, I'm not going to say his name, but it says that it was called rapping. And it says, if I was your father, I would beat the devil out of you, boy. You know your mama taught you better than that. Stop getting played by Darwin and get down with the King of Kings. Now, I thought he was talking about Run DMC for a second, but I mean, he could have been talking about a bunch of King of Kings. He could have been talking about Triple H. He could have been talking, you know, he could have been, you know, but I get that type of stuff. And I think, you know, the black community, and I know I'm doing something right. I think when I think your own race decides that they want to try to disown you simply because they feel like you're doing what the white man has done. And I think that's what stifles us as a community, but that's a whole nother topic for a whole nother day.
Let me ask this question just around this topic, because the skeptical community, you know, certainly as a community, we have noticed, it's hard not to notice it, that there are not very many minorities in skepticism. Just like there's a lot more men than women, you know, when we go to the meetings, there's a dearth of minorities at these meetings. And we're a little bit puzzled by it. We don't, you know, understand exactly why that is. And we would certainly like to reach out more to communities that are not traditionally within the skeptical community. So do you think you have any insight to offer in terms of why you think that there is this this cultural divide?
Well, I would say this. I would say that it's not that there aren't many minority, and I'm going to speak for the African American community. I'm not going to say that there isn't a lot of African American atheists, or you know, in the African American community, because there are, believe it or not. I'm pretty sure that the ratio is probably you know 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. The fact of the matter is that they're afraid to come out. Mm-hmm. They're afraid to come out and say, you know what, I don't believe that shit. Why am I believing what my ancestors, slave owners, forced upon my ancestors? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Let's seriously dissect this and think about this. Why am I thinking about that? But can I say that in my mama's house? No. Can I say that in my grandmama's house? No. Can I say that in my mama and my grandmama's church? No, I can't. Because I depend on my community, and this is a requisite of me being, you know, in my community, is belief in a God. And if I tell anybody that I don't believe in this God, all of a sudden, I'm not black enough. I'm not black anymore. That's just the reality of it.
What I don't understand is, why is there like a water line that you can't, you know, go above? Why do you have to stay a certain amount of black? What does that mean?
Well, I don't think it means anything. I've always said that being black, or like being anything, you know, being black is not what you do. It's simply who you are. I mean, you don't choose to be black. Nobody chooses to be black. Nobody chooses to be white, contrary to what the LDS, you know, church would tell you. Nobody chooses to be black.
Yeah, right.
And the fact of the matter is no matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, you're not going to be any more black or less black. You're simply who you are. You know, it's funny that there are, you know, when people say to other people, when blacks say to other blacks about whites being urban, oh, he's just trying to be black. No, he's not trying to be black, because if he wanted to be black, or if he wanted to be black as bad as he wanted it, he could never be that.
Right.
You know, and it's not like some advantage to being black. There's not some advantage to being white. You know, it's just you are who you are and you play the cards that you're dealt. And I think people just have it kind of messed up to where you have to try to be black.
It sounds like what you're saying is that there's a certain cultural solidarity that is endemic in the black community. You know, and we could speculate that that's historically because that they've been oppressed. So,
like, I don't think that makes you any more black if you believe
in
that.
No, I agree. I understand what you're saying. But there's the perception that because they're, you know, traditionally, historically, an oppressed minority, that they need to have this cultural solidarity, and that makes people, even blacks who are skeptics, who are atheists, don't want to like join an organization and be confrontational about it.
Right. And I think that's because they assume that, you know, atheism is something, first of all, in the black community, atheism means devil worship for the most mm-hmm. part. Most of the time, I actually had a girl, you know, tell me, like, I was talking to one of my dudes at a job I used to work at. And you know, she was like, she said something about going to a Christian college, and I said, you know, that's probably not going to work for me. She said, why not? I kind of avoided it because, you know, at work, you really not trying to get into those type of conversations and stuff like that. and I'm not confrontational when it comes to religion. If you want to open up the can of worms and debate me, I'll hand you your ass. But regardless of the fact, she decided that she wanted to press the issue. So I said, okay, not a problem. Listen, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in, you know, such and such, your God or anybody else's God. And she goes, you know, so you worship the devil? And I spent the next hour trying to explain to this girl that atheism is not devil worship. You have to believe in a devil. You have to believe that a devil actually exists to worship this devil. I thought it was the most asinine thing that I had heard in some time, but, you know.
And if you don't believe in a God, chances are you also don't believe in a devil as well. And that's ironic that they...
Yeah, but it sounds like she was equating not believing in God with being against God. Yeah. And if you're against God, then you must be for the devil. I guess that was the logic that she was employing.
Yeah, that's shady logic.
And just non-belief, I guess, was just outside of her intellectual, you know, repertoire.
False dichotomy.
Let me ask you a simple question. Do you consider yourself a skeptic?
I'm skeptical of a lot of things because I think skepticism is a default position in science. You have to be skeptical. I think that's how we find out about our universe and we find out about the world around us. I mean, people created a God because they didn't know where lightning came from. Somebody was skeptical about the explanation of where lightning came from originally, and they decided to challenge it. Challenging that, you know, gave birth to the whole, you know, I mean, with what we know now as electromagnetism and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that people was, you know, skeptical about when they were skeptical about the original explanations of things that were given.
Great. And the name of this album, The Compton Effect, was that based off of where you were from, Compton, California, or the subatomic process known as the Compton Effect?
It's actually based on the subatomic process known as the Compton Effect.
Okay.
Very nice play on words.
Right. And the interesting thing about it is I took it and ran with it. I was reading... you know, Quantum Mechanics by Albert Messiah, and I remember reading up on it and stuff like that, and I said, you know, wouldn't it be great for people to assume that I'm talking about the city of Compton, even though, you know, I do represent, you know, Compton, you know, as my place of origin and all, but wouldn't it be great for people to misunderstand that and have fun with that and that whole thing, because I am a physics major and I've kind of studied it for the most part. And but I took it as it's a play on words, and yes, it is actually you know, the subatomic process. Yes,
that's what I was hoping.
Great. Now, you going? Do you ever go to any the skeptical meetings or anything like TAM 5? I'm constantly pushing people to go.
Yeah, he's going next year.
Yeah, like
yeah. Actually, in fact, James Randi called me. Basically, in fact, I got a letter from James Randi, and I'm gonna frame this letter. It was really cool. The complete pwning of Sylvia Brown. By him and among other people and stuff like that. I have great respect for this man. So, I mean, yeah, I'm definitely slotted to go to TAM 6 or in 08 in June of 08. So I'll be there. I'll be doing, hopefully, I'll be doing two sets of shows. I'm sorry, two shows. And one's going to be four songs from the old album, and it's going to be four songs from the new album.
Awesome. We will be there. Yeah, we will see you there.
All right, sounds like a plan.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
All right, Graydon, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Always a pleasure, man. You guys invite me back anytime.
Thanks, Graydon.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thanks, Graydon.
Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real and one is fake. And then you all have to figure out which one is the fake. No theme this week, just three random news items.
Good, I hate themes.
Just raw skepticism. Let's do it.
And here we go. Item number one. New evidence strongly suggests that birds did not evolve from theropod dinosaurs, but rather from their close cousins, the sauropods. Item number two. New research contradicts the long-held island rule that small mammals evolve to become larger and large mammals become dwarfs when isolated on islands. And item number three, a new study purports to use brain imaging to tell the difference between true memories and false memories. Bob, go first.
Oh, bastard. let me digest these. Hang on a second. Thank you. Three, new study purports to use brain imaging to tell the difference between true memories and false memories. I'm going to say that's science. Number two, new research contradicts the island rule that... Now, wait, part of the island rule is that small animals evolve to become larger? That's part of that rule? Or it was part of that rule?
Apparently.
Yeah, bastard. Large mammals become dwarfs. That I'm familiar with, but the large mammals becoming dwarfs because resources are low, so there's selective pressure for them to become smaller, but small becoming large, so that totally throws me off. And one, birds did not evolve from theropod dinosaurs, but rather from sauropods. Is it legal for me to ask you to distinguish between theropod and sauropods?
No.
I'm going to say that one, the theropod sauropod is fiction.
Okay. Evan?
I agree with Bob. The new evidence does not strongly suggest that birds did not evolve from theropod dinosaurs and so forth.
It only moderately suggests
it. Slightly to lukewarmly. There you go. Agree with
Bob.
Okay.
All right, Jay.
The last one, the one about the brain imaging, being able to tell the difference between new memories and false memories, I would typically call you up and ask you what this is about. But there's something about that seems a little bit too much on the science fiction end. And also, number one sounds a little kooky to me. But rather, cousins of dinosaur. Hello? Okay, so I had to go out on a limb. Do I strike my own? Or do I go with the crowd?
Make up your mind.
I'm going to go with the telling the difference between false memories and real memories. That's the fake.
Okay, Rebecca?
Oh, man. I'm stuck. I have no idea. They all seem equally plausible to me. So I am going to go with, I'll go with the island rule one because nobody else has. And at least this way, Steve won't win.
Ooh.
Right, that's true. Okay,
yeah, that's my theory.
Okay, so since you're all over the place, I'll just take them in order. Number one, new evidence strongly suggests that birds did not evolve from theropod dinosaurs, but rather from their close cousins, the sauropods. And this one is fiction.
Yeah!
That is the
fiction. High five, Bob.
Ooh, you twisted that from another article, didn't you, Steve? You distorted that one?
Maybe.
Or it's old evidence or something.
So, yeah, that's not true. The evidence strongly supports theropod dinosaurs, and I did use it. I did twist this from an article that is actually more evidence that the theropod dinosaurs are what birds evolved from. Sauropods, I didn't want to say what sauropods are because it makes it really obvious.
Plant eaters?
Yeah, these are huge four-legged dinosaurs, you know.
All right.
So they're just not plausible as a bird ancestor. I guess there could have been some tiny sauropod somewhere. But, I mean, theropods are so much more bird-like than sauropods. It really doesn't really fit. But what this study showed is that theropod dinosaurs have a configuration of anatomy, specifically muscles and ribs, whatnot, that would aid in breathing, similar to deep diving modern birds. The hypothesis is that for deep diving birds, they need the more mechanical advantage from the way their muscles are arranged, so that they could really take deep, fast breaths. They can breathe quickly and to get the oxygen in that supports their high rate of activity. The speculation is then that theropods were probably very active dinosaurs. This includes, by the way, the Velociraptor. That's the one most people remember from Jurassic Park. Number two, new research contradicts the long-held island rule that small mammals evolve to become larger and large mammals become dwarfs on islands. That one is science. And Bob, yes, the island rule does include not just the dwarfism of large animals, but also the notion that small mammals do tend to, like rat-sized animals, become larger. You get giant rats and dwarf elephants. That's the island rule.
All right, but where's this? Why is there selective pressure to go bigger on an island?
The island rule, which is also called the Foster's rule, after Bristol Foster, who first stated this in 1964 in the journal Nature, that large species get small because of restricted or absent food sources, and smaller creatures get larger in the absence of predators from which they would have to hide. That was the hypothesis. What the new study shows was they looked at a database of many, many, many mammals spread throughout the world, and they did statistical analysis to figure out if this island rule actually holds up, if you can predict whether a species will tend to evolve to become bigger or smaller over time once it's, you know, isolated on an island based upon its starting size. And what they found out was that the starting size did not predict whether they would become bigger over time or smaller over time. That, in fact, there were many other independent variables that influenced that. So, yes, it's true that you do find some dwarf species of mammals on islands, but that does not happen to only large species or always to large species. That in fact, it's many variables, such as, you know, like, so food source may be a variable, but that food, you know, limited food source is independent of size. That could happen to smaller animals too, or right. medium-sized animals. It's not limited to just large animals.
That's why I didn't get that. All right, so the island rule is a crock.
This study definitely contradicts it. This is a research team from the Imperial College of London. Dr. Shah Miri from the Center for Population Biology led the paper. She explained, if the island rule was correct, she means were correct, then most large mammals living on islands would be smaller than their continental relatives, and most small island mammals would be larger than those living on continents. Our largest data set of mammal body sizes shows that this isn't the case. There is evidence that most mammal groups show no tendency to consistently either grow larger or smaller in contradiction to the island rule.
I'd hate to be Foster. Imagine you have a rule named after you, and then take it away, psych.
Yeah, I know, it stinks.
Damn.
But that's the nature of science. This means that number three, a new study purports to use brain imaging to tell the difference between true memories and false memories, and that is science.
That's awesome.
True.
That is awesome.
That is awesome. It's getting pretty scary.
It's where the memory is localized, I guess, is what the article I read.
Yes, exactly correct, Bob. So, I've been, you know, reading about this research. There's lots of places where we're using functional MRI scan to look at how different parts of the brain interact in order to produce the ultimate effect of, you know, behaviors and memories and things that we do. And, you know, we're just learning so much about how the brain works in the last, you know, 5-10 years. It's incredible. And just stuff like this is coming out all the time. What they did was they used functional MRI scan to look at which of two parts of the brain which are involved in memory became active when subjects were recalling a true memory versus a false memory. And they used standardized methods to establish, you know, and separate true memories from false memories. So they were using methods that have been used before and have been validated. There are two primary brain areas involved in recalling these memories, the mesotemporal lobe and the frontal parietal network. The mesotemporal lobe is involved in remembering the details of a memory, the tiny little details. The frontal parietal network is responsible for remembering the gist of the memory, right? And these two parts of the brain work together to create the whole memory.
Oh.
So you have sort of the big impressionistic picture, the theme of the memory, and then you have another part of the brain which is providing all the little details. When remembering a true memory, the mesotemporal lobe lights up because the true memory is informed by memory of the little details. So that would light up more than the frontal parietal network. When remembering a false memory, the frontal parietal network lights up more and the mesotemporal lobe does not light up. So you have the gist of the memory, but there are no details. Your brain is not remember, doesn't remember or record any details for that memory. And then so
you're confabulating, kind of.
Well, it's a false memory, so it's either confabulating or it was implanted there somehow. But it's not attached to the details that would be attached to a true memory. That's really interesting.
That's wild. Now I wonder, Steve, though, can you get can you produce false positives? I mean, can you have a true memory that will masquerade as a false memory? And imagine, you know, the abuse of that information. Like, oh, that's the software says it's a false memory, but it's, you know, is that even feasible the way this is set?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And you're talking about how can we apply this in a court of law? Can we apply it in a counseling, session? You know, were you really abused by your parents when you were 4 years old? I don't know if the age of the memories makes a difference. Maybe the details fade away over time and the distinction between the two blurs as time goes by. That's a question that needs to be answered. What is the false positive versus false negative rate in a real-world application? That's something that needs to be answered. So, yeah, there's lots of interesting questions that we would have to answer before we could apply this.
Right.
But just the principle that there's a difference in brain function between true and false memories is really fascinating.
Right, because it's indistinguishable to the person. I mean, you can't distinguish yourself whether it's real or false.
Right.
Now, Steve, I wonder how would this apply to an out-and-out lie? How would a lie be interpreted? I wonder.
Yeah, so you're anticipating my next the thing I was just about to bring up is that this same kind of research, and this came out a couple of weeks ago, we just didn't have a chance to talk about it, is, you know, they're using this kind of same fMRI pattern, recognition approach, looking at which different parts of the brain are lighting up when patients do stuff, and their claim that they could use this as a pretty foolproof lie detector, you know, that different parts of the brain light up when you're consciously telling a lie than when you're not telling a lie. So if we could tell fake memories from true memories and lies from veracity, you know, that we're getting pretty close to, like, you know, really being able to deconstruct memories and claims and what people are saying and to real, you know, true lie detection.
What a tool.
Imagine when that becomes practical and reliable. I mean,
and portable.
You could really peek inside your head, you know.
Kind of scary.
It's scary in a way just to think that anybody could have that power to, like, really know for sure whether or not you were being truthful or lying. But certainly it would also be very practical for society. Imagine there would certainly be fewer. One would assume that this technology, if used properly, would mean fewer innocent people in jail or guilty people going free.
It'll also greatly help with torture and interrogation.
Yeah, right. Well, it may obviate the need for torture. Right? Torture doesn't really work very well, apparently. And also, we're not even talking about personal use. Just you go to Walmart and buy, you know, the Romco lie detector test. You could slap on your spouse and then interrogate them about whether they're being, you know, faithful to you or not. That would be truly culture-changing. I mean, think about the implication of that.
Glad I live in America when that happens.
Guys,
I think that would definitely spark some legislation.
As it should.
And you could argue that was a violation of privacy and the you know, illegal search and seizure type of constitutional rights, that at least in this country that it would be illegal, you know, violation of someone's personal rights. And we definitely have to, you know, the technology is forcing us to think about how rights like that, especially the right to privacy. The right to privacy is going to be absolutely under siege in the next 20 to 30 years just by technology.
Yep. Yep.
And we definitely have to have this conversation about what the implications are going to be. And this, with the functional MRI scan, really peeking at brain function and being able to infer from it all kinds of things, including truthfulness, is going to have a huge impact on that whole discussion of privacy.
And then, of course, the ultimate would be the point which I think will come eventually where we can actually decode the language of neurons and actually determine what someone is thinking or imagining based purely on what imaging scans tell us of their brain.
Yeah, I think that's a lot farther off. But
yeah, absolutely. It's orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude more complex.
But whether it's 50 years or 100 years, it's hard to say, but it's that you're right. And if you put the cap on somebody and you actually can hear their actual thoughts, that's the next layer. But this functional MRI stuff, it's here now. I mean, you know, it's
right.
Not in this Walmart applications, but the principles and the technology, the fundamentals are here now. Evan, can you please tell us the answer to last week's puzzle?
I'll read the puzzle first, though, if that's all right. Is it a carved-up giant from the Atlantic, or is it a dead man in search of an eternal bed? Is it the surgical removal of the ovaries, or a candle in the dark that fills one's empty head? What is it? And the answer is, of course, you probably all guessed, a jack-o'-lantern. I did so. I came up mm-hmm. with this puzzle, woo-hoo! Obviously in celebration of the Halloween festivities. And it was kind of an easy puzzle, so I look at that as my treat to all of you. And I hope you all had a good Halloween and spent time with your families. And if you have kids, there's nothing better than going around trick-or-treating, watching your kids have a great time. So, again, just to review this, carved-up giant from the Atlantic. So the Atlantic giant is a form of pumpkin, a dead man in search of an eternal bed. That's the traditional Jack from Jack-O-Lantern, the story of a fellow who made a deal with the devil. And he couldn't enter hell, but he couldn't get into heaven either, so he walked the earth with a lantern. His name was Jack, and he looked for his resting place. The surgical removal of the ovaries is the gutting of the pumpkin, of course, taking out the seeds mm-hmm. and the insides. A candle in the dark that fills one's empty head, well, that's pretty obvious unto itself. So,
yeah.
Ole Ivand answered first.
Again?
Yeah, I know.
He's a ringer.
He didn't even listen to the show. He just read the thing, and, you know. So, congratulations. And hey, Ole, give someone else a chance next time, okay? Hey, thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So, I don't always post the puzzle right away. Maybe I'll have to hold off.
That's not a bad idea.
Actually listen to the show yeah. for a couple days.
Yeah. It's not a bad idea. Maybe a little 24-hour thing.
Yeah, we do that occasionally. Well, Evan, read this week's puzzle.
Okay. Here we go. This alleged sexual abuser of boys was also famous for misusing adults by convincing them of his clairvoyance. His claims included the abilities of astral travel, to access the Akashic records, and that he could see people on Mars. He is still revered by a great many gullible and forgiving people to be one of the greatest seers of all time. Who is he? Or I should say, who was he? So think about that.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
And Jay, could you please read us your fabulous, well-researched and sourced quote that you chose from for this week among, I'm sure, the hundreds of quotes that you screened?
This is a quote from Edwin Hubble, who was a very famous American astronomer. They named the Hubble telescope after him. Born 1889, died 1953. And he writes, "Equipped with his five senses, man explores the universe around him and calls the adventure science." Edwin Hubble.
Actually, that brings us to the sad end of our show this week.
Oh. Shall we remind everyone, though, to refer our show to someone that is not yet listening so we can try to achieve our goal of 30,000 listeners weekly?
Yes, we are having a listener drive.
Yep.
So get out there. We don't ask much from our listeners, just that they listen and spread the good word.
Spread the word.
So thanks again, everyone. Always a pleasure.
Episode 120 in the books.
Thank you, Steve.
Good episode.
And welcome back, Bob. I hope that you won't be missing any other future episodes soon.
Not till next fall.
They
so
canceled Halloween next fall, right. Bob. So.
And then even then, you're gonna plan your holiday festivities so that you won't be missing any future episodes, right?
I can't make any guarantees. You know how crazy I get.
I consider that a guarantee from Bob.
I shall consider it, sir.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.